Steve Fodor.
Call me Ishmael.
God.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
I don't even know anymore. Ladies and gentlemen, this is what quarantine does to your mind. Thanks, Chip. Thanks for setting us right on the rails for this show. We are back again for another episode of our journey through the adventures of Sherlock Holmes. This is the return of Sherlock Holmes, the set of short stories today, The Adventure of Black Peter. And yes, Chip, this one's about boats and sailors.
And pirates.
And the whale hunting.
Black Peter sounds like a pirate name to me.
It does. It really does. You are absolutely right. This guy could be considered a pirate, right?
Doesn't he have a great big bushy black beard too? I mean, it's all set up.
Sounds like a disguise to me.
That's what I thought. That's exactly what I thought. Whenever Doyle says black beard, I go, oh, it's a disguise. Nope. This was an actual man with an actual big black bushy beard. Black Peter, one of the most villainous of our characters that we've met so far in the Doyle stories.
Just torturous. Torturous to his family.
Yep. But this story starts with a ridiculous and outlandish scene here. Sherlock Holmes walks into the rooms at 221B Baker Street with a spear under his arm like an umbrella.
Can I read it? I love the open.
Go for it. Should we do dialogue? You want to do every other line? You want to do the dialogue? Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You be Holmes.
Okay. Holmes.
Good gracious, Holmes. You don't mean to say that you've been walking about London with that thing.
I drove to the butcher's and back.
The butcher's?
And I returned with an excellent appetite. There can be no question, my dear Watson, of the value of exercise before breakfast, but I am prepared to bet that you will not guess the form that my exercise has taken.
I will not attempt it.
He chuckled as he poured out the coffee. If you could have looked into Arledice's back shop, you would have seen a dead pig swung from a hook in the ceiling and a gentleman in his shirt sleeves furiously stabbing at it with this weapon. I was that energetic person, and I have satisfied myself that by no exertion of my strength can I transfix the pig with a single blow. Perhaps you would care to try.
Not for worlds, but why were you doing this? So you just have this picture of Sherlock harpooning this pig in the back of the butcher's shop. It's absurd.
And the joy that he is expressing when he's telling Watson about it is just silliness.
You're not going to be able to guess what I did this morning.
Yeah, there's no way anyone would go, you know, stabbing pigs. No,
that's what detectives do sometimes. And you guys, this is a story of mentorship, right? So Sherlock Holmes has this young police detective, Police Inspector Hopkins, that he's working with and training. And so it was interesting when Inspector Hopkins came into the room, he's super alert. And Watson says, I recognized him at once as Stanley Hopkins, a young police inspector for whose future Holmes had high hopes. While he in turn professed the admiration and respect of a pupil for the scientific methods of the famous amateur. And I was really intrigued by this story because so many of the American dime novels and the Pinkerton stories are about that mentorship. The older detective who takes a young detective under his wing and teaches him all of the ropes of detection. And I feel like in this return of Sherlock Holmes, even though these stories are set a little earlier on in the 1890s, you do have like a more mature Sherlock who's, you know, at the height of his career. And like every criminal seems to recognize the name of Sherlock Holmes now. And he's actually teaching other detectives, not just Watson, other young detectives.
So not a New Hope Luke Skywalker, you know, Return of the Jedi type of Skywalker, right? Mm-hmm.
And we talk about mentorship all the time. Pam, you're a teacher. Your devotion to your students and that mentorship is on display. I'm a teacher. I'm always trying to help my students to become better at whatever it is that we're discussing in class. And Chip, you do a lot of mentorship with young people as well. This is an important part of all of our lives. It's really great to see this being put forth in this silly little short story collection.
And it's such an important part of detective fiction in America in the 19th century, which I think we don't always think of detective fiction as having a mentorship piece, but it certainly did at this time.
And here we see the influence of the American market, because these stories are going out to American magazines at about the same time as they're going to the British magazines. So Doyle is certainly a marketing sort of author, that he knows his audience.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, I mentioned Alan Pinkerton, who was the famous detective in America who also wrote his memoirs. And Doyle actually met Pinkerton's son. So, you guys, if we're in pandemic for a long time and get through all the stories, the very last novel is set in America and is based on a Pinkerton story. Yeah, the American influence on Doyle is just really fascinating. And you guys have really helped me see that. So, thanks.
As I become literate, your scholarship improves.
Thank you.
That's what we're here for. We're here to help you with your scholarship.
I try.
Put it on your resume. Helped Chip from North Carolina.
Oh, is Chip from North Carolina? I didn't remember that.
Somebody said that. Who knows?
So interesting to see this young person whom Holmes is helping with his detective skills and forensics. He specifically mentions, I was thinking of the forensics when I was doing my investigation. Thank you, Sherlock Holmes. I mean, he doesn't say thank you, but he kind of does.
Yeah.
But then he kind of lines up what he's been doing. So, I mean, Look what I did.
And at the end, Hopkins says, it seems to me that I've been making a fool of myself from the beginning. I understand now what I should never have forgotten, that I am the pupil and you are the master. Even now, I see what you have done, but I don't know how you did it or what it signifies. Does this happen to you in class, Pam, where you pull out the piece of information that a student needs and they are fascinated by it?
Well, sometimes. No, it does. Of course it does. And but I think that what's really funny here is that, you know, Holmes, this reminds us that Holmes and Watson are best friends, because Holmes totally makes fun of Watson if he doesn't immediately see, whereas he's much more gentle as to a student to Hopkins, right? And so in this funny way, this notion of mentorship also kind of strengthens the idea that Watson and Holmes are such good friends, even though Holmes sometimes makes fun of his buddy. It's in a totally different way.
So Hopkins will actually have self-esteem when this is over. Watson, you never know.
I think Watson's self-esteem is fine because he knows he's Sherlock's best friend, and that in itself makes him feel okay.
So we finally get to the case here after all of this conversation about the character development. This is the case of a murdered man nicknamed Black Peter, who seems to be one of the great villains that we've met throughout the canon. But there's a little bit less villainy, in my opinion, because the action of the narrative does not contain his villainy, just the stories of him. He's already dead by the time we actually hear of him.
And in a rather dramatic manner.
Being stuck by a harpoon through his body into the wall behind him. Yeah, that's a pretty dramatic murder right there.
We don't really get many grotesque murders like that, but that one certainly was very vivid. And you can imagine, like, I kept thinking the whole time that, good grief, it takes a lot of strength or whatever shot that harpoon through that guy.
And the gruesomeness of the crime is maybe a little bit allayed by the fact that Black Peter was such a black character, right? He was such a dark figure that, you know, I mean, if this was anyone else, you would just be so horrified. It would be almost hard to keep reading. But it, you know, immediately they tell us, in ordinary life, he was a strict Puritan, a silent, gloomy fellow. The man was an intermittent drunkard, and when he had the fit on him, he was a perfect fiend. He has been known to drive his wife and daughter out of doors in the middle of the night and flog them through the park until the whole village outside the gates was aroused by their screams.
That really is set that something up. You know, he's an upstanding guy, kind of a gloomy guy, you know, when he's not drinking. But when he is drinking, he is just a mean fella who tortures his wife and daughter and embarrasses them. Certainly just not, doesn't sound like the Puritan that he's described just a couple sentences ago.
And you can imagine how he ended up on the wrong end of a harpoon.
Sure. Right?
But, well, plus the seal, he's a seal hunter as well. So that, now, did you guys notice the name of his ship?
Yes.
For some reason, the name of his ship struck me as so funny.
Because you have little girls, and the name, the Sea Unicorn, for you conjures up pink and purple imagery with glitter. That's not what this ship is all about.
The pink and purple years, good right. And this same little note, in high school, my soccer team, we finally made the playoff. And the joke is, we tell this story of how solidly we were beat, and the high school's nickname was, of course, the Unicorns. So anyway, the Unicorns, it's just hilarious.
Wonderful name for a ship. It's a majestic, rare creature.
Well, of course, British. If you think of England, lions and unicorns, those are the animals, right? The state animals.
Well, and it has a big horn that could impale you. So, I mean, it's a totally suitable ship name. But you're right. Like in 2020, a unicorn is 100% related to glitter, especially if you're the mother of girls.
Perspective. Correct. It's all about perspective. Hopkins feels like he has an explanation after questioning Nelligan. Well, Mr. Holmes, I'm very much obliged to you and to your friend for coming down to help me. As it turns out, your presence was unnecessary, and I would have brought this case to this successful issue without you, but nonetheless, I am grateful. He is the student here who is really trying his hardest.
Oh, young arrogance. Oh, my goodness. Luke thinks he's mastered. He's a Jedi.
Indeed. Well, and it's so funny because the whole story, in a sense, like here we're just at the midpoint of the story, and we know that the first suspect was never going to be the real suspect anyway. But certainly we work towards this absolutely awesome line where Hopkins feels he has the murderer, and Holmes says, "It seems to me to have only one drawback, Hopkins, and that is that it is intrinsically impossible. Have you tried to drive a harpoon through a body? Oh, tut tut, my dear sir, you must really pay attention to these details." I just
join me early in the morning as I go stab some pigs.
Why weren't you at the butcher's? Because that's what an investigator would do.
Tut tut. So tut.
Very British.
Dear little man.
Yes.
Dear little man. Little man. Yeah.
So what's going on here is they think that this one kid is the murderer here because he has some paperwork and some what is it? Is it stocks? Or is it some securities?
He's got a good financial motive. A good motive.
And he's trying to break into this man's place to find this paperwork, and so he's a suspect. But Holmes goes, no, that's a tiny little kid. He cannot drive a harpoon through a man and through a wall. I've tried it.
As you should have done. Although, don't you feel like Holmes is super gracious to this young inspector compared to how, you know, sometimes, like, remember the solitary cyclist when he was making so much fun of Watson for his poor skills? He doesn't do that at all. And in fact, Holmes even says, simply by having the good fortune to get the right clue from the beginning, it is very possible that if I had known about this notebook, it might have led away my thoughts as it did yours. Well, you guys know that's not true at all, but he's super nice to this kid and he wants to build up his confidence, this young detective.
Wonderful. It's terrible when he's so mean to Watson sometimes, but at least we see here that Holmes can.
They're buddies.
I get it.
Come on. They're like on the same footing. They're buddies. He's as an equal.
There's an understanding.
It's like they're doing a podcast together. I get it. But at least we see this kind heart from Holmes helping this kid to become the best investigator that he can be.
Mm-hmm. Forgive him, and if he comes back a couple years later, then Holmes has the right to go after him. Yeah, rip his heart out.
Right. Well, and that would mean that he had earned Holmes's respect, as Watson has, right? True. Maybe. Well, one of the things Holmes does here is one of his favorite things to do is instead of going out to find the real criminal, the real murderer, he actually has the real murderer come to him. And that's a wonderful, wonderful scene where they have this parade of people who have applied for the new harpooning job. And the ones who are too skinny are sent out. And then the perfect murderer, this giant man, Mr. Patrick Cairns, he comes into the room and he's like, yep, I'm here for the harpooning job. He's the guy. It's so great.
So always have three interviews, right? That's
right. Yeah, it was like a joke, right? The first guy, no. The second guy, no. The third guy is the punchline. Yes.
Perfect humor from Doyle here. Absolutely. The rule of three is employed very well here. We find out that Holmes knew this man's name. He had his initials on this tobacco pouch that was found, just happened to be the same initials as the victim. But Holmes knew that it wasn't his tobacco pouch because he was noted for not smoking tobacco. So it must be somebody else with those initials. That's pretty convenient, Doyle.
Steve, don't ruin a good story. Come on.
That's a good story. I don't disagree with it. This is a good story, full of really dark imagery and some really funny imagery. When they finally capture Patrick Cairns and they have him down on the ground in 221B Baker Street, Holmes says, "This room is not well adapted for a cell, and Mr. Patrick Cairns occupies too large a portion of our carpet." That is the funniest way to say, take this man away, officer.
Right? Hey, by the way, did you guys notice, I think it might have been a couple stories ago, but I forgot to mention it, that they have a bearskin carpet in 221B Baker Street?
I just took that as rote. I just assume that they have a bearskin carpet. I know that I watch a lot of black and white TV, but the Addams Family really affected me, and I assume every character has a bearskin carpet. Don't you?
Mm. Well, of course.
And of course, no bears were harmed in the writing of this story.
Thank you.
A little disclosure there.
No. One thing that really made me laugh as we were prepping for this episode was that both of you guys noticed a line that I didn't notice at all about rum. What was this line?
Yeah, this was such a moment. It was just a throwaway line in here, but Holmes states, how many landsmen are there who would drink rum when they could get other spirits? Yes, it was certain this was a seaman. This was a sailor because sailors drink rum. That idea of rum as opposed to the other possible spirits that the man had in his room, brandy being one of them, of course, thanks Doyle, but they chose rum.
Yeah, I caught that and I was like, all right, so what? I'm going through the Jack Handy fuzzy memories moment. I know there's something in my brain about this. And I was trying to figure out if not only was it a sailor's drink, but was it a poor man's drink? Because if the other spirits, of course, we would choose those. And there is some history of rum. When Prohibition ended down in New Orleans, if you were going to buy vodka or whiskey or scotch or something of that nature, they immediately, you were ordering rum along with it. And that's the reason why the hurricanes, as far as the drink, became such a prevalent drink in New Orleans, is because in order to buy something, you had to buy, you bought a case of one liquor, you'd have to buy maybe three or four cases of rum. And of course, you had to find something to do with it. And there may be a little bit of history to it, but I just could not find it on my search of the Google this morning.
Huh. Certainly that stereotype of sailors with rum, there's got to be some historical basis for why rum was on ships more often than any other sort of liquor. And we'll have to do some research.
Maybe we should go down to Key West, probably for a month or so, and just ask some people, some locals.
Changes maybe, in latitudes, changes in attitudes. Yeah, I'm with you. Let's go.
Someone could set that up for us. During this pandemic, we're not doing too much when school ends. So.
Road trip, let's go.
So I didn't notice this detail about the rum, but I did notice that Black Peter, who's a pretty bad guy, is especially horrible when he's been drinking. And it does strike me like we are now into the early 20th century, 1904. So we're only 15 years from Prohibition. And there is, as part of the women's movement, this real concern with like who controls alcohol and how does alcohol impact domestic violence and abuse. And so I think, again, like Doyle has his finger on the pulse of a lot of the social and sociocultural questions that are at the center of people's thoughts in the early 20th century.
That's a great point.
Peter is kind of a representative of that sort of the really dark side of alcohol.
Doyle is on the forefront of modern thought.
He's bringing up so many of these types of issues. The birth of the feminist movement we've talked about so many times in these stories. He is right there on the forefront.
Mm-hmm. And the whole, like, I mean, obviously this story doesn't really get to it, but that tension about new science, new advances in science and technology and spiritualism, and the fact that he was really invested in both makes him so interesting.
Is there an ending to this story, Pam?
Kind of. So yes. So we end on Holmes. "You must obtain the release of young Nelligan as soon as possible," said Holmes. "I confess that I think you owe him some apology." And this is to his mentee. "The tin box must be returned to him, but of course the securities which Peter Carey has sold are lost forever. There's the cab, Hopkins, and you can remove your man. If you want me for the trial, my address and that of Watson will be somewhere in Norway. I will send particulars later." The end. And I was kind of curious about this. Watson and Holmes are heading to Norway. And I don't know if that's like, hey, everybody, write a fan fiction about a Norway case, or if they're just sort of inspired by the fact that Nelligan's father was in Norway to think, like, take a vacation or something. It's a kind of an interesting ending.
The love of salmon. They love salmon.
It's certainly not stated that they are going there to continue this case, but maybe that was the implication. But yeah, I think it's more of verisimilitude here. I think it's more, hey, we'll be around. Maybe we'll be in Norway. Catch us in Norway next weekend. I don't know. I don't know what's going on there.
But either way, however we read the Norway reference, it's a, okay, young man, you just let me know if you need me for any assistance. I remain your mentor. Have a great day. Awesome. You've got it from here, buddy.
That's pretty awesome. Again, as a teacher, I try as hard as I can to give that sort of feeling to all of my students. I'm here for you. You can contact me anytime you need me. And this is pretty amazing for Doyle to, again, be on the pulse of so many different types of people and readers here.
So midnight's a great time to call Steve. He loves
it. Yeah. Yes, Chip. Thanks for that. And me, of course.
Oh, yes. Anytime, yeah. Right?
My virtual office is open 24 hours a day. I might not be in my virtual office, just like I wouldn't be in my real office, but it's open right now as we're speaking, just in case students need me. That's how it is. That's just how it is.
It's true.
This has been great. This is wonderful. This is a fun story with enough darkness in it and so many issues to unpack at this stage of Doyle's writing. I am intrigued for our next episode tomorrow, The Adventure of Charles Augustus Milverton. Another name, two names in a row. Hey, okay, have you noticed a pattern to these story titles?
Well, they have been all adjective noun. Right. And he's really tried to have like really easy to remember, like the solitary cyclist, the Norwood builder, Black the dancing Peter men
is an adjective and a noun. But this is our second name in a row here.
Yeah.
It's I think that there was some pattern to it. Maybe it's just my human brain trying to find patterns and things that aren't really there. But I think that he's got two bicycle stories in a row. Two names in a row, two really dark villains in a row. This one's kind of the third one in a row, but okay. Interesting. I'm loving this. I hope everybody out there is enjoying it as much as we are, having as much fun with these stories as we are, and having something to talk about with your family and friends. If you have something that you want to share with us, give us a call or an email. We would love to hear from you. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of that feedback from around the world, and get ready for tomorrow's adventure. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Ishmael.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
We'll see you in the future.
Hopefully. Let's go look for some more.